broadcasting from Melbourne, Victoria. You're listening to the Investor Exchange. Tune in each week and listen to the guys from United Global Capital discuss the topics that matter the most to your finances. Each episode will help you separate the noise from what really matters, giving you timely and actionable information you can use. We'll cover areas related to financial markets, property, politics, personal finance, and the economy. Now, here's your host, Stephanie Sumner.
Hey, guys, how are you?
Very well.
Another week down?
That's it. Another week closer to the finish line.
Well, let's hope so, in terms of the lockdown, anyway. Yeah.
Well, you've got the football to keep you company. I know that you guys were talking about the football before we got on air. Who's playing tonight for you guys?
It's 1-3 at the moment, which is Port Adelaide and Geelong. So the good thing is one of them has to lose.
Yeah, we hope so. Well, and even if they don't, it gives Collingwood a chance to still move up higher if they draw, because Collingwood is only half a game behind third position, even though we're playing like
busted asses.
Yeah, you could say that.
The big question for me is around, do we get the grand final holiday? Not because I love football, but I'd just like to know if we still reclaim that holiday in Victoria.
Well, you might get it up there instead, Steph.
I don't think I'll be up there for much longer. I think I'll be back pretty shortly.
Fantastic. Well, yeah. We're just taking it one day at a time, just like the footballers taking one game at a time.
Yeah. I think I can. I might get some masks up here and sell them on the black market when I get home because they're a lot cheaper here.
I've got heaps. Yep.
Has anyone forgotten to actually wear their mask when they've left the house?
I've come close to a few times.
Yeah, I left the house without one, but I only got some 2 minutes up the street before someone was walking the other way, and I saw they were wearing a face mask, and I just thought, oh, gosh, face palm, and turned around, came back.
Yeah. An unusual thing to sort of, you know, to include in your life, isn't it? It's just not something that anyone's really used to, huh?
Yeah, it is. And for us in Melbourne, we look at the other states around Australia and just think, oh, my goodness, how lucky are you guys? Melbourne is not the place to be at the moment.
Mm. I haven't actually heard whether New South Wales is bringing in the rule of face masks, but I know that was sort of hotly debated over the last few weeks whether or not it should be. I think they're encouraging people to wear it on public transport, but I don't think it's hit just yet for them.
No, not really. Well, they don't have the levels of community transmission, and it's each outbreak is, for the moment, being able to be mostly contained. Mm. Certainly not on the scale that Victoria has been. I think, didn't the Premier of New South Wales say for people to keep a face mask in their pocket?
She might have.
It's a bit of strange advice because there's not a lot of breathing done through your pockets, so I'm not sure what good a face mask is going to do there.
Well, if it's your back pocket, Louis, it might help.
Yeah, I know. So it's just a strange old time, but anyway, we'll see how it all goes. What are you guys going to do to keep yourself sane this weekend, Joel? Are you going to watch more football?
Oh no, it was my birthday yesterday, so I'm feeling a little dusty this morning after finishing off a nice. Well, I didn't finish off the bottle of scotch, but I certainly gave it a good little crack, Brett. Thank you very much for that.
Well done.
I'll probably try and get out and go for a bit of a walk, I think, and try and get out and about and try and enjoy some fresh air. It's been a little bit cooped up, and by the time you finish work, it gets dark. You're not finding a lot of opportunities to get out and enjoy the sunlight. So that's what I'm hoping for this weekend.
Still only limited to an hour.
Yeah.
Don't comment on that. You've been out more than once.
There's ways around it. You can go out for an hour of exercise, and then you can go out for an hour of walking around the shops to go and get your food. And then it's very hard for them to figure out exactly how long you've been outside for and how long you've been inside your apartment for.
It's a rule that allows them to clamp down on the people that are really taking the piss. Mm. Like if someone is out all day long, then they've got avenues to give that person a fine if they just can't find them, or if they knock on someone's door that they need to check up on, and if they stand around that house for an hour, well, then they can go straight to the fine option.
with not much open, I mean, really, what on earth are you going to do anyway, to be perfectly honest? So.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And it's just part of the measures to be able to clamp down on the people who should be self-quarantining or something like that. But they're not taking their responsibility seriously.
Yeah. Louis, what are you going to do? What does a typical weekend look like for you at the moment, especially with a little one? How are you guys keeping yourself amused? We obviously only an hour out of the house for you guys.
Not much different. We'll just have our hour outside, and the weather's often cold and raining anyway, so we don't spend too much time outside. But if we do, we'll go for a walk around the block, or ride bikes around the suburbs. And that's pretty much it. We'll get some sporting equipment and play in the street.
Yep.
Yeah. So it's pretty basic lifestyle at the moment.
Yeah. What about you, Brett?
Pretty similar. We push the limits. We walk for exactly 60 minutes when we can, and then we'll find a way to go shopping, which because of our location and where it is, we have to walk to the shops and back. Yeah, not much else. And then otherwise, it's watching whatever I can on live sport and catching up on a little bit of work. Might as well while I've got the time.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I think that we always talk about you know, where that work life sort of starts to blend during COVID. So it's very hard. You do have to keep watching that it doesn't creep in completely. So
yeah.
Anyway, we're going to kick off our first topic for today. I'm actually going to start with Brett. You were going to talk to us a little bit about how different property markets are being affected in different states. Can you tell us a little bit more about that, Brett?
Yeah, I thought Melbourne's lockdowns are the most extreme in the country, but we're seeing every capital city and every state having slightly different impacts of the COVID-19 scenario on property prices and sales volumes and even rental yields and occupancy rates. So I thought it'd be worth having a look and seeing, you know, how each market is being affected differently. If we look at values to start with, interestingly, pretty much every capital city other than Canberra is down over the last month and the last quarter in terms of its value. But if you look at the year, if you look at where it is on a rolling 12-month basis, the only market that's low, well, there's two, are Perth and Darwin. So on a rolling 12 months, so prices compared to the same time last year, the overall residential property market's still up. So we're yet to see a significant impact.
Wow.
And Darwin, though, I'm intrigued by that because they're states that are not hit as much during COVID. Why is it, what's causing that?
So my perspective when we look at this data is that the reductions we're seeing in values, and obviously the biggest markets are Sydney, Melbourne and Brisbane, just given the volume and the population, they're only down slightly, like only around 1%, half to 1% over the last month. So not significantly enough. So,
and what about Canberra?
So Canberra's the outlier. It's actually seen in the last month prices have risen 0.6% and over the last quarter have risen 1.3%. So it's the only one that's showing positive gains in the last, well, since COVID and all the necessary measures have kicked in.
Canberra's not exactly the most enticing place to want to live, even though it's a lovely city.
No. So true. Not 100% sure what's behind it in terms of why Canberra's performing like that. The challenge with dwelling value prices, though, is because it's taken on a median and it's only taken on the properties that were sold in that period, you can get a totally different basket of properties sold from one period to the next. So
interesting.
Definitely. Clearance rates are interesting too. Nationally, we're seeing an average of around 66%. You can probably discount a number of states because they have virtually no auctions. Like Hobart had no auctions last month. Perth had 17, Adelaide 45, and Canberra 53. The biggest change is the volume that we're seeing in Melbourne, which typically leads the nation in terms of the amount of auctions every week. It's down below 300 per week at the moment, which in good weeks we're seeing in excess of 1,000 typically in Melbourne. So it's doing probably what we'd expect given, you know, the provisions that are in place for lockdowns and you know, you can't have the open for inspections and on-house auctions. So a lot of people would just be withdrawing, potentially going online but not having as much confidence with the online options performing to the level they want. I think it'll take a while for it to rule. I think because there's other factors that are going to play into this, we're going to have to wait and see what happens with mortgage deferrals and employment. They're going to be the two biggest factors, and then immigration. So I can't see that any property market is going to come back out and just rule straight away. I think it's going to be a slow build up for everything to start recovering and growing again. Mm. It's just, there's just too many other factors that are going to play into how the property values are going to be impacted.
What about Sydney?
Look, I think the biggest unknown is how long each state is going to have lockdown provisions or anything in place. Obviously, Victoria is the worst hit at the moment, so you would anticipate its volume and its market's probably going to be the most impacted on that basis. But having said, it's really hard to tell which market is going to recover the quickest because there's just too many variables. Yeah. But we know Melbourne and Sydney are always the strongest market and they've got the highest volume of properties. I think Melbourne long-term is probably still the market to probably outperform out of those two, with Melbourne's population forecast to grow and get beyond Sydney's population in the next 5 or 6 years.
Brett, do you find it surprising that the property markets are really quite resilient to the short-term impact of COVID and more seem to be driven by their longer-term economic factors?
No, I actually think it makes sense when you look at the factors around it. And the main one is that when you look at JobKeeper and the mortgage deferrals, I think we've said this a few times, is if there is a reason for people to have to sell and there's more sellers than buyers, which will cause the supply-demand equation to drop and therefore force sales come about. Now, none of that's happening yet. And then if you look at it, the main thing that's happening is the only people that are buying or selling are those that are in a position where they're comfortable to do so. So there's probably less active buyers, so the market's not as active.
Yeah, and I was just reading in the news about some reporting from Commonwealth Bank. The number of home loans on deferred repayments has actually fallen from a peak. So people are starting to get back onto their regular repayment programs.
People sort of on hold with it, though, because they were scared of what was going to happen, the prospect of their job, or were these people that would have lost a job?
Combination.
It'd be all of those things in there, but the bank wouldn't have just put your repayments on pause because you'd asked. They all have some kind of criteria to make sure that you're a person who is actually impacted.
Yeah.
You couldn't go to them and just say, I'm scared of losing my job.
I'm worried, yeah.
You would have had to go to them and say, I've had my hours reduced, or I have lost my job, or I am on JobKeeper, or something like that.
And do you think that the banks will be as flexible with that kind of thing going forward? As this sort of continues, do you think that this will, banks will remain sort of being very flexible with the repayments, or is this going to tighten up as things sort of get back to normal?
It depends on what the circumstances are. And this is a funny situation where it's actually good to be part of the majority in this bad situation, because if you're one of a huge bunch of people that are at risk of defaulting on your repayments, well, then they're going to be flexible with all of those people because they don't want them all at once. But if you're on the margin, if you're about to default when no one else is about to default, then they'll just allow you to default. And they'll put you into their provision for bad debts. So yeah, it's good to be part of the pack in this situation. If the rest of the economy picks up really nicely and you're left behind, well then you're probably at risk. But if you're one of the hundreds of thousands of people who are still impacted, well then they're not going to tighten up too quickly because they don't want to trigger all those defaults at the same time.
Well, it's going to be an interesting ride, I think, for the next few years to see how this housing market sort of plays out. Brett, I was just going to ask you too, on sort of those new developments, what are you thinking with sort of new developments as well? I mean, do you think people will still be interested in purchasing, apartment-style living? Do you think that this is going to shift the way that people look at getting into sort of more expensive type of family properties versus an apartment? Do you have any thoughts around...
I can't see any reasons why, you know, recent trends would change significantly, other than the potential that people are going to be working from home more than they have in the past and may look to say we'd like more space and are willing to move further out. But I still think there's a lot of people that love the location they're in, or they're living in a suburb for a reason, whether it be schools, access to where their office space is, or just lifestyle. So I'm not seeing we're going to see a major shift because of this. There might be subtle shifts, but I'm not seeing that there's any reason for trends and the type of, I guess, ratios of apartments versus houses to change that significantly.
Yeah. What about sort of this? I mean, this trend at the moment is, you know, people are starting to think about purchasing regionally and having this holiday house where they can work out of there. Do you think that that's kind of a fad? And sort of going forward, do you think people will go, well, that was sort of a mistake, we don't end up using that property, and we'll see sort of a glut of those regional properties come back on the market in a few years' time? Or do you think people will really maintain them and decide they're going to keep them?
The biggest unknown in my eyes around all this is what is going to be the real long-term normal after COVID-19? You know, how much will fundamentally change? As an example, one person we deal with pointed out that what happened at September 11, whilst it was a significant event, it really did change the way we live because of the security measures we all go through every time we jump on a plane now. With COVID-19 and obviously working from home and all of these other things we're doing, what is going to be the long-term impact once a vaccine or a way through it is found? Will we go back to how we were, or will we be changed forever? Really hard to tell.
I've got no data for it, but what I'm personally seeing and predicting is that COVID has been an accelerator of trends that are already in place. So I think there's already been a trend of people moving to regional areas for the lifestyle and taking advantage of working remotely, using technology, and then using the faster and better regional public transport to get into the city when they need to. And I think that trend is just going to be accelerated. But not to a huge extent, but to some extent, I think it's going to be accelerated by this situation. That's my personal prediction.
I can tell you as a business owner at the moment, I'm spending a fair bit of time considering what the future workplace looks like. And it's bloody hard. You're stuck between this world where you know now that the market has changed so dramatically from a commercial office space perspective, where deals now are really, really attractive. I mean, I'm seeing, I'm actually speaking to and we're using a leasing agent to negotiate our next round of occupancy. But, you know, we're looking at incentives that are anywhere as high as sort of 30 to 35% for new tenancies. So that's 30 to 35% of the full rental value over the term of the lease. So if you've got a three-year lease, you've essentially got 1 year rent-free. You know, if you've got a five-year lease, you've essentially got 1.5 years rent-free. Yeah. You know, and these, like when I was, prior to COVID, when I was looking around and doing our searches, we were lucky to get 15% as a rental incentive when we first started looking. And in fact, it was even getting close to sort of 12, 12.5% because the occupancy rate was at an all-time low in Melbourne prior to COVID, and now in the space of 5 months, everything has just changed.
That's Victoria's situation. But anywhere else, you know, like here in Queensland, it's as normal. So I feel like it's sort of going to be an interesting one to watch this, because the other states are just not seeing that same kind of event unfold as what we're dealing with in Victoria.
A friend of mine who's at Ord Manette, which is another private wealth management company in Sydney, and he said that his office is only probably around about 25 to 30% capacity. Ord Manette is trying to get as many people back into the office, but people aren't returning.
Businesses do have the right to ask you to come in and work. So this is going to be a very interesting scenario as it plays out, because it is in your contract that if your employer wants you in the office, that's where you're going to be. So, I mean, I think this is going to prove really, really difficult. Because that is part of it. Depends how flexible an employer actually wants to be with this new world.
Yeah,
certainly does. And it's one thing in the current environment, even in New South Wales, where there is still the COVID risk, or at least perception of COVID risk in all states of Australia.
Mm.
To ask you forced to return to the workplace in that situation is going to be completely different to if we have a vaccinated population and there is therefore almost zero risk of COVID, no more risk than a car accident or another major disease or something like that. That'll be a different circumstance to ask your workforce to return to work.
It will, but I think there's another can of worms that it opens up, and there will be a lot of anti-vaxxers out there that will refuse to do it. And I think some people will sort of also decide that they won't want to do it because they don't want to return to the workplace. So I think it's going to pose all kinds of different problems as this goes on, to be honest.
Very interesting way to observe what society does and what people are capable of doing. I heard it the other day, and I might have said it on the podcast a few weeks ago, that of someone saying that man is smart enough to get themselves to land on the moon, but dumb enough to deny that it ever happened.
Mm-hmm.
You've got different pockets of society that have different values and have different actions, and
100%.
It's interesting to see how that all interacts and where it will all end up.
Yeah, and I think, for September 11, I mean, that was an absolutely horrific event that did change the world. But as awful as that was, it was something that happened very quickly. And this is just such a different scenario. You know, it's such a long-term effect that we're seeing. And, you know, there'll be so many things that are going to change, but gradually, I think, as well. I mean, those security measures were put in place after September 11 so quickly, but we're still all sort of nutting this out on what we're going to do.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's just, I guess, a watch this space. But, Brett, just any more closing remarks on the property market just before we head to a quick break?
Yeah, I thought it was worth also touching on just the vacancy rates around the major cities in Australia too. So nationally, believe it or not, the vacancy rate for all residential properties in the capital cities in July 2019 sat at 2.3%. As of July 2020, it's actually only 2.1%.
Okay.
So interestingly enough, the vacancy rate has actually dropped across the nation over the last 12 months, which I would have thought, if anything, it would have increased with a lot of people potentially leaving rental properties and going back to live with family and finding more people living together to save funds. Different for each city. So Melbourne's been the hardest hit, where its vacancy rate's gone from 2% last year up to 3.1. So, you know, we've spoken about Melbourne's, with all of these impacts, being the hardest hit, and that proves to be the case. And Perth's been the one that's declined the most, going from 3% to 1.3% over the same period.
Do you think, though, that the rates, haven't been hugely dramatic because people are being propped up with JobKeeper and JobSeeker and have gone, well, you know, I'm sort of going to be doing
it. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, and there's also a moratorium on evictions as well at the moment. So even if people are under financial duress and can't pay their rent, they're not allowed to be kicked out or evicted.
How long is that in place for?
Well, it was in place until September when they first put it in place. So I'm assuming, well, certainly in Victoria, I'm assuming they'll extend that. I can't actually say where it is in the rest of the country.
Yeah.
Like a lot of things, that there has to be an end at some point in time, because the funds will dry up and landlords... Now, if the banks stop the mortgage deferral program and landlords are relying on rent to be able to pay loans, well, they can't just let people stay in their residences without paying anything. It's just a whole knock-on effect. So, musical chairs to some degree, and the music has to stop at some point in time.
And we must all remember that the banks aren't just a money pit. They also owe people money and interest on their funding as well. So at some point in time, the banks are going to be forced to actually start to, ask for their money that they're due.
Yeah. Well, it's just anyone's guess at the moment. It's sort of one of those scenarios where often you guys have the answers, but at this stage, I guess just nobody really knows. So anyway, we'll watch it unfold. We might just take a very quick break at the moment, and we'll be back with Joel to give us a bit of a market update after this break.
Want to learn the strategies that have achieved returns more than double the return of the average superannuation fund? Each day, clients of United Global Capital are using strategies and tactics that were once thought the domain of the professional investor or the super rich. Book your seat at UGC's Financial Fast Track Seminars, where you'll learn the science behind selecting high-performance stocks and real estate, how you can participate in advanced strategies like property development, short selling, and international investments, as well as how to protect your wealth against major adverse market events. To secure your seat, simply go to ugc.net.au/events and select the seminar that suits your needs. Seats are limited, so book your spot now.
Welcome back, guys. Now, Joel, you're just going to give us a little bit of an update on the stock market and also your monthly newsletter that you've recently put out to your clients.
Yes, thanks, Steph. Around this time of the month, we usually produce our monthly market update, which is a look at some key stats and some key findings that we've uncovered with respect to where we see markets currently positioned, stock markets that is, and what that might give us in terms of some insight as to where we believe markets might be sort of setting up for future moves. As I look through a number of the key charts that we run through and that we monitor on a daily basis, we've got to remember that we have had a very strong period of price performance, particularly in the United States. Here in Australia, we've essentially gone nowhere for the best part of about 2 months now. And our market isn't as strong as what we're seeing over in the US. And that's probably because we're seeing that, you know, one of our largest economies being the Victorian economy, has been slower to recover and, in fact, is still probably in recession right now. Interestingly enough, though, we did see that the unemployment rate ticked up to 7.5% yesterday, which was actually below what analysts were expecting. And it's a sign that at this point in time, there hasn't been the wholesale retrenchment that that many analysts and many economists had been predicting. Whether that continues, that's yet to be seen, but certainly the rise in unemployment has been at a slower and steadier pace than what most people first feared, and certainly it's probably got a lot to do with the JobKeeper program that the government has put out, as well as the fact that we've been able to navigate our way through this with largely just one state being in recession, and the rest of the country is largely getting back to life somewhat normal or similar to what they were experiencing prior to COVID-19 breaking out. But when we're looking at how markets are performing, it's always important to have a look at how the US market is actually tracking. I've said this a few times now, but I think it's important to reinforce this, that if you're not doing your analysis on what the US stock market and the US economy is doing, then you're really missing probably about 50 to 60% of the important data. So with the US market being worth more than half of the total equity market value in the world right now, in fact, it might actually be more than that. I haven't checked in on those stats, given that the US market is actually significantly higher over the past 12 months, particularly the NASDAQ, and the S&P 500 is now getting back to all-time highs and is now right within a new all-time high, closing in on a new all-time high, only about 0.5% off an all-time high where it was prior to COVID breaking out and the stock market peaking in late February. It's important to just take a quick look at where things are at. And right now we're seeing that, particularly on a short-term sentiment basis, there's a little bit of a warning sign here. We're seeing that bullish sentiment in the US for US advisors is currently sitting at around just a shade under 60%. So that means that most investment advisors in the United States, professional investment advisors, are at a relatively high reading in terms of those people who are bullish. And bearish investment advisors is sitting below 20%. Now, when we see, you know, bulls at a high close to 60, that's quite an extreme level. And when we're seeing bears at a very low level, that's quite an extreme level as well. So there's a bit of a warning sign here that we might just be getting a little bit frothy and that people might be a little bit too complacent. We're also seeing the CNN Fear and Greed Index is also starting to tick up close to about getting closer to that 80% range. And at 80%, that tends to be an area where markets tend to find that they sort of struggle to move beyond that. Once again, it's another sign of sentiment, investor sentiment. And when people are fully invested and are very bullish, that tends to be a contrarian indicator, suggesting that we might be in for a period of either softness or sideways consolidation. And when we also look at the put-to-call ratio, put-to-call ratio is at an all-time extreme as well. What that basically means is that most people are, most investors are very much buying and invested in call options. Now, call options are a bet against a bet for the market to continue to rise. And when there's a lot more buying in call options than what there are in put options, which are a bet for markets to fall, once again, it's another sign of sentiment starting to get to elevated levels.
And that's a pretty good one, because you're generally talking about your more informed investors using puts right. and calls. You don't have mums and dads using put and call options to trade. You've got sophisticated investors doing that.
Correct. That's right. So in the short term, we're seeing some fairly frothy sentiment indicators here, and it's just a little bit of a cause for some short-term concern. Underneath it, though, if we're having a look at the broader technical picture, I made note that that the S&P 500 had its fourth consecutive month where it closed higher. When we apply a momentum indicator, which is what we call the moving average convergence divergence indicator, or it's otherwise known as the MACD, it's a widely used technical indicator. And it gives you a sense of how strong the momentum in the stock market is, and it can also be used to identify divergence in strength. So if the share price is rising, but the MACD is softening or declining, that can be a sign that we're getting close to the end of a rally. What we've actually seen here, though, is that looking at the U.S. stock market, when the U.S. stock market, the S&P 500, has closed up 4 months in a row, and the MACD actually turns positive, that's actually been a very good sign historically for stocks. Now, it hasn't happened all that often. In fact, it's only happened 7 times since 1942. But when we have a look at how the short-term performance of the U.S. stock market has performed, it's been quite mixed, very muted sort of returns over over a 1 and 2 week basis, and even sort of over a 1 month basis. But when we start to look out to 3 months, 6 months, and 12 months, this has actually been a very powerful indicator. And in fact, in each of the prior 7 instances that this indicator has flashed since 1942, we've had 100% success of high returns over a 3 month, a 6 month, and a 12 month basis, for an average return of 5.4% after 3 months, 10.9% after 6 months, and 19% after 12 months. What this is sort of leading us to sort of infer is that we might be coming into a little bit of a period of a short-term correction. That correction at this stage, we don't know whether or not it's going to be a correction in price, where stock prices actually come off, or it's more of a correction in time, where stock prices tend to hold up but go sideways. So when we're trying to identify exactly what type of correction we may face, we've done a little bit of an extra work, and there's actually a research company out of the US that we subscribe to, Lowry Research, very good institutional research house, and they do an enormous amount of work studying buying pressure and selling pressure. And in fact, they have an indicator, their own indicator, called the New York Stock Exchange Buying Pressure Index and the New York Stock Exchange Selling Pressure Index. And what we've seen take place since the early part of, or the mid part of June, is that both buying pressure and selling pressure have been in the decline. And so what that's saying is that right now, with buying pressure actually declining, it's suggesting that people aren't anywhere near as aggressive in their buying of stocks right now. They're probably, those people who have wanted to buy have already bought. And they're probably just taking the foot off the gas a little bit here. But what it's also saying to us is that sellers aren't getting aggressive either. Sellers don't have conviction. Sellers aren't seeing reasons to you know, put their foot on the gas. And so what that likely suggests is that while we might be heading into a soft period, which seasonally August, September, and October are the weakest months of the year, In fact, the month of September averages a loss of 1% per annum. Now, if what it's sort of saying is that as we move into the weakest months of the year, the correction, if we are to get one, is probably not going to be a correction in price. It's probably more likely to be we bide time here. We might be going up and down, and we could be range bound for a period. We might see some swings of sort of 5 to 7%, but nothing too crazy or too scary. And we might just bide our time here for the next few months. So what we're doing is we're using this period. We actually get very, very active during periods where we believe that corrections are likely to take place, or where corrections are actually taking place, because that's where we find our best new ideas. We search the market for those stocks that are acting strong, that are holding up well, that are creating well-formed basing patterns, and are setting up for new breakouts. And so right now, our team have been really trawling through the earnings announcements. We're right in the middle of earnings season in the US, and the Australian earnings season is about to you know, really get into the meat of its corporate announcements. So we've been screening a lot of stocks. We're coming up with some really interesting ideas, and this is where we start to really turn the portfolio over. So during periods of correction, this is where you can really set your portfolio up for the next leg higher when it comes. Now, when's it going to come? Well, we don't know, but we generally have some form of, we can probably look forward at some of the key events that are on the horizon here and suggest that as we're heading into the US presidential election, we're likely to probably see a stock market that's on the sidelines, investors on the sidelines to see who wins, what policies are likely to come into place, what policies are likely to be announced by the two presidents, the presidential candidate and the current president, and get some clarity on that. So I would expect that markets are going to probably bide time here until the presidential election's over and done with, and we have some sort of sense of understanding around what the next 4 years is going to look like, who's in power and what type of policies are going to be in play. I would suggest, though, that I don't think it's going to really matter who wins, whether Trump gets in or whether it's Joe Biden. What the stock market's probably just wanting to know is just that there's actually a resolution. But in terms of which candidate actually wins, I don't think that that's going to have a meaningful, 6 or 12 month impact on where the stock market wants to head. We're very much in a recovery phase here. The US is opening up, albeit in certain areas where some states have started to shut back down again. But in general, the US is recovering strongly. Unemployment in the US is coming down. Europe is opening up again. We're seeing Asia is opening back up again. And largely, even Australia is opening back up again, except for Victoria. So, overall, we're in this recovery mode. I think the underlying fundamentals are still strong. We're seeing lots of evidence to suggest that the medium to longer term stock market performance is still likely to be quite positive going forward, albeit we might be heading into a bit of a softer period over the next few months.
Look, what we're going to do is take another really quick break, and we're going to be back with our final topic for the day.
Are you concerned about your finances? Maybe you're not sure if you'll have enough money to retire on. Or maybe you've received a redundancy, inheritance, or even a significant promotion, or perhaps a life-changing medical diagnosis. Regardless of your concern or financial position, United Global Capital's advisors are experts in the areas of strategic financial planning, taxation, superannuation and self-managed superannuation funds, risk management, estate planning, and investments. Don't let fate dictate your financial future. Take control today and contact United Global Capital for a no-cost, no-obligation financial strategy consultation. Simply call 03 8657 7640 or email info@ugc.net.au and book your appointment today.
Hey, welcome back, guys. Now, this is going to be quite an interesting topic. Louis's going to talk to us today about what people are doing with all their cash that they've got, a bit of extra cash, while they're not spending it throughout COVID-19.
Yeah, thanks, Steph. Some numbers came out recently and have been talked about a lot about what is Australia's actual unemployment rates, and people saying that it's actually as high as 10 or 11 or 12% when you include people who are currently on JobKeeper and not actually working. But that means that close to 90% of people still have their regular jobs. The underemployment rate, which is defined as people who are not getting as many work hours as they would like, is somewhere between 10 and 20%. So that added to the unemployment rates means that 70% of people still have the jobs that they want to have at roughly the pay that they would that they are happy to continue to work at. So my point is that the majority of people are in the situation, but they still have their usual amount of income. But a lot of people are working from home and not spending the amount of money that they would normally be spending. So what are you doing with all of that cash?
E-commerce.
Absolutely. Well, Joel, you know that for sure, because you're looking at all the sales data that comes from PayPal, one of our holdings, and ZipPay and Afterpay. Absolutely, there's a splash of cash on e-commerce.
Maybe also his purchasing of a few fine wines or alcohol online too.
I'm doing my bit to support the economy.
That's right, absolutely. But you look at the amount of money that's being saved versus the amount of extra money that's being spent, and even if you've got an extra few e-commerce purchases every week, the amount of money that my own household is saving and a lot of households are saving just by not commuting to the city every day and not buying your lunch every day. I mean, $50 a week per person on public transport, and if you're paying for parking in the city each day, then it's at least $100 a week. I'll tell you who's probably making a lot of money right now is car insurance companies, because there's a lot less accidents right now. And they're probably still going to jack up your premium next year. But anyway, I'm getting off points. In fact, let me continue to be off point for just a moment. I've heard that isolation e-commerce spending has similarities with holiday spending. You know, when you're on holiday, you're in a holiday town, the weather's warmer than normal, cruising down the main street of a holiday place, and you just make this decision, maybe linen pants do suit me really well because you're in that holiday vibe. Or maybe that tie-dye shirt, or if you're in Byron Bay, yeah, I can totally pull off a straw hat and a tie-dyed shirt. And you make that holiday purchase. I'm finding that that isolation spending can have the same thing. When it actually arrives on your doorstep, you might be thinking, what the hell was I thinking making this purchase? That's isolation spending. So just be careful that what you're spending your money on is actually a worthwhile longer-term purchase. Anyway, coming back to topic, please, Louis, what are you doing with all that cash? I've spoken about having a savings habit in previous episodes, and now is the perfect time to start that savings habit if you haven't started it already. So a call out to people who have listened to past podcast episodes to the idea of setting up a regular savings plan into a different bank account just to get into a habit of saving money. Yep. If you haven't done it yet, now's a great time to do it with all that extra time on your hands and all that extra cash in your bank account. And the point of this is to have the habit. It doesn't matter how much it is, even if it's $10 a week, that's not going to be anything noticeable over the course of a whole year. But once you've got that habit of savings happening, that's the hard part. And the easy part in future is to amend that habit in future. And so for people who have taken my great advice and started that savings habit, now is the time to amend it. So if you do have the extra cash, change your savings plan from $10 a week to $50 a week or $100 a week. Or if it's a monthly habit, just change the amount of that habit. because you do have this extra cash to splash. So if you have now increased your regular amount of savings, and then when you come out of lockdown, you try and keep that in place and see if your new post-lockdown lifestyle can handle that new level of savings. And if it can't, that's fine. You've still got the money in the bank account. If you need to get that money back, then you can. But just see if you can keep that high level of savings. So then you've now got this habit where you are saving money on a regular basis. We've then got some considerations. If you come out of the lockdown environment and you're thinking, and I've got an extra, I don't know, a few thousand or whatever it is, what can I do with a few thousand dollars? You can look to putting it into either boosting your emergency fund and just continuing to hold cash for emergency purposes. And that's what a lot of people don't have. And that's particularly important in case we do need to go back into lockdown. And I don't want to burst people's bubbles here, but we've got to be thinking about the possibility of third waves. Look at how well New Zealand did to suppress and eliminate coronavirus, but now they're back into a lockdown again. So we could have it here. I can see it happening either late this year or early next year. We might have a third wave. But if you already have your emergency saving fund in place, well, then you could look at putting towards investment or reducing debt. I'll tell you what is always more powerful than a one-off investment or a one-off reduction in debt, and it is that regular savings. $1,000 a month of regular savings over a long-term period of time is way more valuable than a one-off investment, even of a large amount. If I've got two clients, one's got $20,000 one-off investment or a one-off savings, and if I've got another client who's got $1,000 a month of regular savings, the regular savings is going to kill it every time. And we can do some awesome longer-term financial planning strategies around debt reduction, asset investments, superannuation contributions, way more effectively with $1,000 per month than a one-off amount that might be pretty substantial. So if you can take this opportunity to get your regular savings plan happening, then that is going to be an opportunity well worth taking. The last thing is, I know coming out of lockdown, people are going to have this extra cash and they're going to want to spend it. I am desperate to go traveling again for something. I'm even willing to go to, I almost said I was willing to go to South Australia, but sorry, no, not willing to do that.
They don't want us there either.
But I know that people are having their post-lockdown ideas forming in their head. And again, I want you to identify how much am I going to allocate towards spending on that, and how much of this savings am I actually going to keep for long-term savings purposes. So just have that delineation in your head. By all means, go out and blow some cash and blow off some steam coming out of lockdown. I think that's a natural and probably healthy thing to do. But keep in mind, just make a rational decision of how much money you want to keep in the bank having come out of this situation.
Yeah.
And that's everything I want to say on cash coming out of lockdown.
I think it's really good advice. And I think having a proper bit of a savings plan in place, and Louis, I can certainly relate. I'm sure a lot of people throughout COVID, certainly in the first round of lockdown, I was just so bored that I'd buy anything online because I was bored out of my brain. And it's sort of, I think it's that point in your brain where, you know, it gives you that sort of happy feeling to make a purchase and see something arrive, because it sort of feels good, doesn't it, to get something from the outside world. So
it's an endorphin rush.
That's exactly the word I was looking for. It's
there
endorphin.
You go.
Yeah.
And you get a little dopamine hit.
Yeah.
And dopamine is the enemy of long-term success.
Yeah. At least it was, I think I'd purchased a toaster and things that I actually needed around the house. So there were good investments, wine glasses, because Joel tends to break them quite regularly. So they weren't all in vain.
The word investments has been banned in my household when it relates to household items.
Oh, really?
That is not an investment, Steph. A toaster.
How am I going to toast my toast?
An investment. If it doesn't produce income or grow in value, that's That is not an investment.
I can charge for toasted sandwiches, Louis.
One of the best marketing jobs came out of the fashion industry when they started calling pieces of clothing
investment pieces. And I kind of agreed, like, if you get a really nice blazer, it can go with everything. That is an investment piece, you know? You don't need more than one
yes,
blazer.
I hear this.
Tell me how much income it produces, Steph.
Well, it keeps you in a job if you're looking nice.
Wow. What kind of job is that? What kind of employer is that? Sitting in a meeting with your manager saying, well, Steph, you know, your performance hasn't been so good, but
you've got a nice
you dress
blazer.
Really well.
You feel good about yourself and what you're wearing. I think that helps too. I've got to justify it somehow, Lou.
Exactly. Got to justify it.
Yeah, but no, but definitely good points. I know you're the sensible one, and we do all have to take a bit of stock for the spending and put a plan in place. And I think it's a really good time at the moment to be able to do that. So listen to Louis, guys, if you're out there.
And work for a better employer that's going to further your career based on hitting your KPIs.
Right. Let's throw it over to the last segment of the day because we are running out of time. It is You Can't Be Serious. What have you got for me this morning?
I've got a Chinese man who was, you know how kids sometimes see a piece of wood on the pavement and they want to jump on it, and if it's covering up a hole, it's a bit springy. It's a fun thing to do for kids. So a Chinese man decided to do this, obviously not the smartest, and also a problem for this situation is he's not only the weight of a full-grown man, he's the weight of an overweight full-grown man, estimated at between 300 and 400 pounds. So he's been bouncing on this piece of wood, which is covering up the top of a well going underground, and the piece of wood has broken.
Ooh.
And he's fallen into the well. However, his fat belly actually saved him from falling all the way in. And there's this picture of him
like a cartoon skit.
Stuck up to his belly button and then just waiting to be rescued. So his fat gut was both his downfall, literally, and then his savior.
Who's got another one?
Well, I'd like to talk about people in a position of power being able to make decisions and rules purely out of self-interest. So no one does that better than Donald Trump. His latest one is to increase a water flow, water pressure ruling that's been in place since 1992, purely so he can keep his hair perfect. Yes. He's complaining that not enough water comes out when he's in the shower, so he wants to increase the flow, which is, I think it's 2.5 gallons a minute, and he's saying it should be increased because he can't wash his hair or his hands properly enough.
But I do have to agree with Trump. I hate a shower when it's not, you get a trickle out of the tap and you think, oh, there's nothing worse. So I do understand.
Wow. I didn't think his tiny hands needed a lot of water to wash them.
Well, guys, I've got a story about a wedding speech gone wrong. We've all been at those weddings where you've thought, ooh, should they have said that? Ooh, you know, that's a bit of a cringeworthy moment. In fact, I've got a friend of mine who gave a wedding speech at his best mate's wedding, and they haven't spoken since the wedding. Anyway, in the UK, there was a bride whose mother was kicked out of the wedding as a result of her speech about her daughter. Comments included, "I'm happy the bride found someone that's not into looks, because I don't know how she would have afforded the plastic surgery." And the other one was, she told the groom she hopes he will be happy in a crappy apartment, because her daughter would never be able to afford anything better. And then the bride's mum goes on to say, "Good for the groom for putting up with the bride's medical issues. Bet he wouldn't have been interested if she had been diagnosed before they got together."
Oh, hang on. That's actually horrific.
What a roast.
So the speech was actually cut off. The groom's the wedding party for the groomsmen.
There you go. I couldn't think of it either, Joel. You're not alone.
The best man.
the groomsman came up and took her off stage and then booted her out.
Oh, I think I would boot her out for that as well. That's actually awful. Took it into
his own hands.
Yeah. Wow. Always ending on a high, Joel. Yeah, that's have no words for that one. Well, on that note, we better wrap it up there for the day. But thanks for the weddings to start again. That's right. I'm sure there'll be some interesting stories coming out of isolation. You never know. People might vent their frustration at wedding speeches. So anyway, we better wrap it up. But thanks for your input this morning, and we'll speak to you all again next week. And thanks for the listeners for tuning in. Have a fabulous weekend.
Thanks, Steph. Thanks,
listeners. Bye.